Hi, this is Lady T, and welcome back to another episode of I Believe in Jesus, But, where I answer those questions that they don't talk about in church. I have always been perplexed by certain characteristics displayed by the Old Testament God. He's a God that becomes angry and frustrated by his children's disobedience and wants to kill them all. I would be institutionalized if I did that. He sends his followers off to war and tells them to kill everybody, including the animals, and take the land. Political leaders who have done that in the past or who would try to do that today would be considered barbaric tyrants. He's a jealous God who wants all eyes and attention on him, even though there is no other. Yeah, my girlfriend had a husband like that. He was considered an egotistical narcissist. So in my Christian journey, initially, I would innocently ask questions about those subjects. But I often heard the common phrase, don't question God. And over time, like everyone else, I allow the theologians and the preachers to quell my questioning soul with their long-winded apologetics, which could be summarized by the phrase, God is God. He can do whatever he wants. But being a lover of Christ and being a student of the Bible, as well as a student of human psychology, the questions never really went away from me. So you can imagine my joy when I ran across Valerie Tirico. Valerie is a licensed psychologist. She's the author of the book, Trusting Doubt, and she's an evangelical Christian who has turned in her Get Out of Religion card. I share our discussion here on the emotions and the psychology of God in hopes of answering some of your questions, while also respectfully honoring your walk with the biblical God. Enjoy. Thank you, Valerie. I still appreciate you joining me today. Can you tell me, before we get started and I start asking the deep questions about God and his psychology, can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Thanks for having me here, Tisha. I'm a psychologist by training, as you know, and a former evangelical fundamentalist. I grew up in a church called Scottsdale Bible in Arizona. It's now a very successful evangelical megachurch. And then by my own choice, attended Wheaton College of Billy Graham fame. And gradually, I would say, evolved over that time a more and more idiosyncratic, perhaps, form of Christian faith as it became clear that there were moral and rational contradictions in the belief set that I had grown up with and that I was struggling to hold on to.
Long were you in the church before you started coming to recognize the conflicts, the contradictions?
That's a long journey for me. I remember in high school struggling with the idea that my dear friend Kay, who was Mormon, was going to be tortured eternally in hell and that I was going to be blissfully indifferent to that.
So you were in high school when you came to that conclusion and when you started waking up to that.
So idea. I was struggling with that in high school. I was struggling with the fact that I also had an eating disorder at the time. I was bulimic and I prayed for God to heal me of that eating disorder and it didn't go away. And, you know, eventually I would come to the understanding that God gives us, you know, tools to heal. He doesn't expect us to pray our broken bones away. He expects us to kind of find the resources and tools and kind of our bodies naturally heal themselves. And we have acquired knowledge in order to do that. And I think the same thing is true with mental health issues. But at the time, that was also, I think, something that created early cracks in my evangelical belief set.
That's so interesting. So I didn't grow up in church at all. And by the time I turned 19, I started looking for an understanding of God. And so I did a survey, a study of different religions and came to, you know, the God of Christ, Christianity. And I immediately had questions. So one thing that just always amazed me, I was 19 and I went to my Bible teacher and I asked, so in the book of Genesis, when Satan tells Adam and Eve,
Surely you won't die. God said you'll die if you eat from the tree. No, you're not going to die. God just knows that if you eat from the tree, you'll become like him. You'll know good and evil. And sure enough, when they ate from the tree, God's response was, uh-oh, man has become like us and now knows good and evil. And so I was like, wow, wait a minute. Satan didn't lie, because our theology says Satan lied. Satan is a liar. And he lied. But no, actually, he didn't lie. They did become like God and they didn't die. God told them, you're going to die if you eat from it. They didn't die. So actually, Satan told the truth and God lied. But you can't say that. You can't say
Yeah, that's a tricky one, right? And then there's
Right.
so many other layers to that epic kind of mythic story of our beginnings, right? Which, like, why would you, if they didn't know good from evil, why would you ever put that temptation,
Right.
like, how, who would create a child and then, set a cookie in front of a 2-year-old and say, if you
Don't
don't
touch.
touch, and if you touch that, I'm gonna torture you.
Right. Right. Yeah. And so that was also my dilemma as well. So I got past the Satan didn't lie, and I had some other questions, and I fell into the excuses that we give about God's behavior, especially the Old Testament behavior and responses. And because I allowed the excuses in my head, it helped me. I mean, Christianity, the Bible helped me, because I grew up on the South Side of Chicago in the midst of the 80s with the poverty and the drugs and the gangs and all of that. And so understanding that God loves me is very, very comforting. But also, like you said, you look around and you go, but wait a minute, all these other people are suffering and God's going to punish them because they didn't hear that they're supposed to get saved. So yeah, so the psychology of God really just didn't click for me and didn't make sense to me. But tell me, how did you get to the place where you started observing and looking at God's emotions and God's psychology? How did you, what made you decide to go that route?
Well, I think it is the perfect intersection between my training as a psychologist and my journey of evolution away from evangelical fundamentalism. So even though, even if you kind of say God is some entity that is outside of human beings, what we know is that we access all realities through the lens of our own psyche and through our own kind of physical biology and through the way in which we are optimized to survive and thrive in a world that is largely populated by other human beings.
Okay, so explain to, first off, what is emotion and why would we expect God to have the same emotions that we have?
Well, in my series, God's Emotions, I wrote a definition of emotion. Emotions are evolved functional feedback processes that serve the well-being of sentient, mobile animals and social animals in particular. So that's a super wonky definition. But what if I kind of unpack that emotions aren't just something that happens. They're something that happens for a purpose. And that purpose is to help us be able to survive and thrive in a world of physical realities and other human beings.
Okay, all righty. And so I have my emotions so that I can react, so I can respond, so that I can deal with what's going on
Right.
externally. That's the reason for the chemical changes that we call
Thank you.
emotions.
You just said it much better than I did. Much more
Okay.
simply and clearly than I did. If we couldn't move, if we couldn't react and respond and change what comes next, there would be no point in having emotions.
Okay. All right. And then, so we have emotions. They help us to navigate this 3D world. But we see in the Bible, God also has emotions. And I'm amazed that God has the same emotions as us. And like, he's jealous. One scripture that has always amazed me, and that's the one where God said, I am a jealous God. And I've always thought, why would God be jealous when he, first of all, there is no other God, and he's the best and the most wonderful. He's omnipotent. He's the most powerful. What would I have to be jealous over with these beings that I created? Why am I jealous? You know, and I was even explaining to my son one day, I said, if you called some other woman mommy, I don't care if you were 3 or if you were 13, you're calling some other woman mommy would not make me jealous. And if I showed any jealousy, it would be, I would be considered an immature mother. And yet God said he's jealous if we look to other gods. Why does God have that emotion?
Exactly. You put it beautifully. I think that you could say the same thing about God being angry, right? So we often hear of God's anger or his wrath in the Bible, but anger is an activating emotion, right? It is something that when we experience a threat, a physical threat, a psychological threat, or we're thwarted in, so a threat to one of our objectives or goals, it gives us, you know, it gives us extra physical strength and focus in order for us to be able to be more powerful in a conflict situation, right? So if God is all powerful, doesn't need to be angry. He doesn't need to kind of go Green Hulk, right? And bulk up. He's already as bulky as he can get.
He's already bulked.
Yeah.
Right. And so what does that say about us, that we have a God who is angry, who is jealous, who is vengeful, who makes us go out and kill everyone in the land, including the animals and the trees?
And the trees. I think what it says is that angry God is based on our perceptions of powerful people, right? That we are a hierarchical species, just like a lot of other primates. Right. And that one of the things we know about powerful people is that, interestingly, there's some research that shows that strong, powerful men and beautiful women have more tendency to get angry than people who are perceived as less dominant or less powerful, because they think they can get away with it. Right. Anger is a coercive way of getting other people to go along with what we want. It doesn't require persuasion or enticement or nudging or patience, right? It's coercive. And so more powerful people are more likely to get angry. It makes sense that also that kind of, then we see it, God as kind of ultimately powerful, that we might model him on the tyrants of the past. Coming back to this, that for whether it's a higher status person or whether it's a frustrated child, anger is about not having other ways to get what you want, or wanting to take the kind of shortest path to control other people to get what you want. And either ways, it seems very unbecoming of a God.
I don't remember the theological arguments for justifying God's anger, other than he's holy and therefore he's entitled to his anger. But actually it looks immature. It looks inappropriate. I mean, some of his emotional responses, as we record them in the Bible, are definitely too explosive. It doesn't even make sense. Like a perfect example is, again, Old Testament, when the prophet Elijah, I believe it is walking, and some kids are teasing him and calling him bald head. And then, you know, these two wolves or bears come out of the woods and they maul the children. And, you know, it's like, that was God's will. And, you know, that was done on purpose. It's like, really, God, you're going to kill the kids because they teased a grown man?
Yeah. You know, that story of Elisha and the bear coming out and eating these, you know, of course, people have to try to kind of make sense of all this stuff, right? And so you'll hear a story, a sermon in which they were like, well, they weren't really, they weren't really children. They were adolescents, and they weren't really kind of just teasing. They were behaving like, you know, who knows, gang members or something. And yet, even so, like, who would look at that and say, when, you know, you have a bunch of adolescents behaving badly, that the consequence should be to tear them apart physically and
kill them all, right?
I mean, that worked. I mean, for a human to do that, yeah, that makes sense. But for a God, I mean, why not just make Elijah float, or Elijah float above them and fly away? I mean, that would be more graceful than killing them all.
I mean, tearing them apart limb from limb is like the ultimate like example of stand your ground, right?
So you're saying that this really speaks to us as humans and our perception of God based on our understanding of power.
That's right. And then what happens is we end up, and I think the more you think about it through this lens of God having emotions or God having a kind of human, a very humanoid psyche in the Bible and in Christian tradition and in kind of most religions, even if the gods of other religions that might like have the forms of animals or monsters or whatever, all tend to have very human psyches, because it's so hard for us to get away from projecting ourselves onto the world around us and onto our conceptions of the supernatural.
And do we see that in other religions as well, where the other religions also make God more human than more divine, and then excuse the God's human behaviors?
Absolutely. So the religion that I'm most familiar with, of course, is evangelical Christianity, because that is my lived experience. It's what I grew up in. But you see that in, you know, kind of the, you know, if we think about what we term the mythologies of other cultures and traditions, you know, in Hinduism, in the kind of the Greek gods, obviously in the other Abrahamic religions, you have these same concepts of God, gods that have human emotions, that are punitive, that have blind spots, that kind of somehow yearn for human adoration, that, you know, almost seem to share our sense of insecurity.
As Christians, we know that's wrong when we look at other religions. I think about the, the Muslim religion, where if they sacrifice themselves, they get to, if they die in the name of Allah, they get to go to heaven, and they get, what is it, 40 mm-hmm. virgins. And I'm like, really? Is that important? Virgins are really that important to God that he's going to grant you that as a reward? That sounds like some man-made
it
stuff.
It sure does, doesn't it? You know, I mean, again, that's a great example, because the whole Iron Age focus on virginity, right, had also a practical aspect to it, just like emotions have a practical aspect to them. So, you know, in a context in which people had no means to control their fertility other than abstinence, or other than, you know, it was really, and in a context in which there were no social safety net other than extended family hierarchies and things like that, and inheritance patterns needed to be very crisp and clear, the primary way to kind of orchestrate all of that social structure was to control the fertility of women, right? I mean, you wanted to make sure that babies were of known paternity, of known parentage, of known pedigree, if you will, and that there were ways to kind of manage social conflict that way, ways to manage financial flow, economic assets, et cetera, right? So what's interesting, though, is that these things that kind of have practical origins, I think, then get codified in religion as God's will, and they take on a life of their own. And so here you have this kind of, in both Christianity and Islam, a kind of almost fanatical obsession with female sexuality and kind of controlling female sexuality, which no longer has the same practical purpose it used to have, but now has become sanctified.
All right. So we project. Explain projection.
Projection is a kind of psychological term that goes all the way back to Sigmund Freud. And it's basically the idea that we we tend to see in others what's actually present in ourselves. And so when we are, and it operates in two ways. One is that kind of, if we are angry, for example, we tend to expect other people to be angry with us. If we are not trustworthy, we tend to assume that other people are the same, not trustworthy. But it also has this secondary function as a defense mechanism, which is that there's a blame component to that, and then we tend to kind of, whatever we are at fault for, we tend to kind of put those faults into other people.
Yeah, and we do that with each other, and we also have, we can clearly see that we've done that. That's even in right. our religion, across cultures, and even mm-hmm. across history. Based on that, Valerie, so what does that say about, is there or is there not a God? Can we believe the Bible? Can we trust the Bible? Should we? You said that you now live a understanding of spirituality different from religion. Tell me, how do you see God, and what becomes your sacred text, your standard?
Well, so you and I think kind of land in different places around the set of questions that you just asked. I think that our direct experience is a more trustworthy guide than a set of handed down texts. So we know now, again, much more than our ancestors did about the origins of the sacred texts that are bound together in the Bible. We know that some of them were derivative of pre-Christian and even pre-Hebrew religious texts and hypotheses about the world around us. We know that the texts that were in the, that are assembled in the Christian Bible were assembled by Catholic committees. And ironically, most Protestants don't think of the Catholic hierarchy as infallible, and yet we treat those decisions mm-hmm. that they made to bind together some texts and to burn others as an infallible set of decisions, right? So when I look at Christian history and I look at the Bible specifically, I see human handprints all over it. And yet what we have is what Christians have long called natural revelation, right? We kind of talk about special revelation and natural revelation, and natural revelation is our direct experience of the world around us.
Okay, so basically you're saying that, so my perception of God, if I'm looking at God through my lens and looking at the way I understand nature, then that is my perception of God, and that's better than using the sacred text. And then you get to have that same choice, and Billy Bob gets to have that same choice, and then that's better. But then what becomes the standard?
Well, so I think that, you know, Houston Smith, who was a scholar of the world's great religions, said that they all converge on three things, which he called charity, veracity, and humility. And I, you know, By charity, what he meant is the King James kind of definition of charity, of love, of being able to kind of care about the well-being of others like we care about our own well-being. Mm-hmm. Veracity, he meant truth-seeking and truth-telling, right? And then humility means being able to kind of recognize ourselves as just one among many, to recognize to not want or assume more for ourselves than we are willing to assume for other people.
You know, I 100% agree with you. If we live our individual spirituality that's centered on love, that's centered on recognizing and acknowledging other people, then the world will be a better place. And this is where I have the conflict that I have. We have so many people who lived such different, who had such different experiences that they will come up with something mm-hmm. crazy for love. You know, Jeffrey Dahmer, I love her, therefore I'm going to eat her. Mm. I'm going to kill her and eat her. And that is my definition.
Well, but, and I would say that's wordplay, right? That's external to kind of these kind of fuzzy sets of concepts that I think most of us can come, most of us know that that's not what the word love actually means, right? One thing,
right. But for someone who has grown up a particular way, You know, love can mean something completely different. And so that's the reason for the standard. Well, I appreciate our time and thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your information. This is something that we as Christians need to wrestle with, acknowledge, and then choose. I mean, you know, my eyes can be open to understanding that the Bible was written by men who had the challenge of their own culture and their own limited language to express God's love for us. I can understand that and still make a decision to live an individual spirituality with the Bible being my foundation. But for us to close our eyes 100%, completely worship the text itself and make excuses for a God's behavior that we wouldn't even tolerate among other humans, to me, that is not acceptable. So I appreciate you sharing your knowledge with us.
Well, there you go. Thanks for tuning in. Hey, do you have a deep philosophical, theological, or metaphysical question? If so, I would love to hear it. And if you're interested in my lightly researched opinion, I would love to give it. You can always contact me one or two ways. Feel free to email me at assistanttoladyt@gmail.com, or you can download the Anchor app, do a search for this show, and then leave a voice message for me. And hey, I'll even consider playing your question, your feedback, or your comment on my next show. Cool, huh? Please share this show with someone else who is on a spiritual journey and stay tuned for our next episode of I Believe in Jesus, but...